James, are you recording?
James is recording.
Okay, good.
I have it on good authority.
Excellent. Why someone is screaming at you from upstairs? Quiet down!
You kidding me? I'm in the monkey room. It's quiet as a dormouse in here.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm in the basement. The cat is sitting as close to the pellet stove as is humanly or felinely possible.
Without bursting into flames, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. I don't think she'd mind if she did.
Cats have that amazing ability.
Mm-hmm. I just want her to toast up and then walk over here and sit with me for a little while and warm me up.
Ah, right.
She's got the good seat.
Because it's all of 20 degrees in Connecticut, right?
Yes, yes. It's the coldest. It's been a really mild winter, but this is the coldest we've had. So welcome to the Cats and Weather podcast.
Exactly, yep. I'm your host.
And I'm the jester.
You're the plucky comic relief.
There it is, plucky comic relief. Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's going to be the Instagram picture of me in a clown outfit. Yeah. All right, hop topics. Well, actually, why don't we get out of the way a little bit of housekeeping?
Yeah, housekeeping first.
So, really, as part of the housekeeping, we want to remind everyone we have kind of relaunched our Patreon side of things, and we have a great new thing that has taken off out of the gate really well, and it's a live Q&A channel on Discord. And we put this thing live 3 or 4 days ago, and we're already having great conversations in there. So thank you to our patrons who are jumping in, asking questions, that mobile access for you and I, James, being able to just see our phone beep at any point of the day and have pictures and comments. And it's been great. It's been great interacting with everyone.
And super easy. Holy cow.
Oh, yes. Very, very simple.
And for me, everybody knows, for me, if you can make it easy, I'm pretty quick. If it requires me to, you know, I don't know, do something, not so much.
You're not quite the technology Luddite that I would... You know, I wouldn't quite throw that at you.
No, but it's not good either.
I encourage you all, the next time you're in front of a screen, to look for the Saturday Night Live skit last year where they had old people using an Alexa.
Oh, God.
It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Anyway, back to housekeeping. Yes, that's pretty much it for housekeeping. Check us out. Again, thank you to our patrons for continuing to throw great questions at us.
Mm-hmm.
And that said, our topic today came from Chad, one of our patrons, who said, it's winter, it's a great time to do trellis work, but it seems like every off season I'm retightening my trellis wire pretty significantly. And for the first few years, I figured this was just poles settling, but I'm 5 seasons in and it's still happening. What's the trick? My poles are straight, my anchors are secure. And then he says, for the most part, in parentheses, which is kind of funny. Uh-huh. So is this just an issue I'm going to have to deal with all the time, or is there something systemic I need to look for? Why are my wires limp?
Right.
I added the limp part. I figure we can play off that a little.
Yeah, I'm sure you can. Yeah, you'll do a good job on Instagram with that.
Oh, yes.
Great, great question, Chad. And the answer is yes. It's something you always have to deal with. So why is it moving? So you're like, okay, I'm going to tighten these suckers up, these lines up to, you know, low middle C. They're going to be super taut and they're not going to sag at all during the year. And I did it once. Why do I have to do this again? Well, a couple of reasons. And it all comes down to stress on the cable load. And you have a couple of things going on here. So depending on the type of cable you use, whether it's a 7x19 type cable, which is, you know, very, very fine wires and gobs and gobs of them. So basically 7 bundles of 19 wires each. That's what 7x19 stands for. It's also called wire rope, right? Or are you using something like 1x7 cable, which is a single, you know, wire, but there's 7 of them. They all have different elongation rates, so how much they stretch. That's something the manufacturer will post, as long as you're, you know, within its load rating. And so, Greg, when you showed me this question, I did pulled up my calculators yesterday, and started running some math just to see under load what the stretch is. And let's say you've got a row that's 500 feet long. Okay, I'm going to do this all in imperial units, so all of our non-North American folks, bear with me. So let's say you get a row that's 500 feet long. Your poles are 50 feet apart in the row. And when that cable has got hop plants on it, you know, every 3 feet or so, and when I plugged in all the math, when those plants are at full maturity and your cable is sagging, you know, 8 inches to maybe even a foot, depending on how tightly you had it pre-tension, you're putting like 2,500 pounds of load in that 50-foot section just by virtue of having those plants hanging there.
This is literally brewer's droop.
Yeah, it's brewer's droop, yeah. Hop grower's droop. So you're like, wait a minute, those plants don't weigh 2,500 pounds. I'm like, no, they do not. This is called tension, and there's all sorts of math that you have to do for catenary sag. Look that up. The moral of the story is here that just having, you know, 17 hop plants in the span of 50 feet at full, you know, height and maturity is causing that line to droop. So by a lot, like I said, almost 2,500 pounds of tension. If you're like, all right, I'm going to tighten the shit out of this cable to get it to go taut because this is driving me nuts, you're putting that cable under more and more load. And pretty soon something's going to give. Something's going to break. And in situations where, let's say you're using a 3/16 cable and it has a working load limit of 2,800 pounds, the breaking load is 5 times the working load limit. You're like, okay, so that's 10,000 pounds, so I'm good, right? I'll be safe. Well, you don't want your cable to break. So where's all that force going to go? The cable can only stretch so much, and it's usually less than 1% based on what I saw manufacturer recommendations for both 1x7 and 7x19. When you put them under that kind of load that we're talking about, their rate of elongation as a percentage of the length is anywhere between 0.5 and 0.9% of the total length. So if your row is 500 feet long, right, and you say, all right, my cable's going to stretch 0.9%, that's like 4.5 feet. A 500 foot long cable's going to stretch when you put that kind of load on it, just by virtue of it being elastic, right? Mm-hmm. It stretches, or I should say, right, plastic, because it doesn't necessarily recover.
Now, 4.5 feet across that shouldn't be it should look a little looser. It shouldn't be a material sag, though, should it?
Oh, absolutely it will. I mean, think about it. So if you tighten that cable up so you've got very little sag, and then you extend it 4.5 feet, everything's going to look loose. I mean, it's not going to be like, you know, drooping down by 2 feet every pole section, but it's going to stretch more than you think it will. Because you're like, well, it's steel, it doesn't stretch. Steel is plastic, right? It's malleable, it's going to stretch. And the type of steel and the cable that you're using stretch more or less. If you're using like solid, like 2-strand barbless wire, that stuff stretches more like 1.5%. So you could be talking over 500 foot row, you could be talking 8 feet or more of stretch. It's a lot. So you're going to see that cable stretch a little bit every year because it's not going to be under full load, let's say, the first year. It's going to stretch a little bit, then you tighten it up. Then it's going to stretch again. Then you're going to tighten it up. It's going to stretch again until you take that, you pick up all of that plastic elongation out of that cable. Yeah, you're going to be going and tighten it up. And I think his question was, well, you don't see all these other, you know, growers, you know, big growers going out and retightening their fields all the time. I said, you don't? How do you know that? I don't know that for a fact. I've seen plenty of large growers, you know, doing trellis work. But, you know, they may also have more poles. And if you have more poles, that means your spacing is less. That means you're going to have less tension on the cable. So maybe their plastic elongation is less. So that's that.
What's the lifespan, and I'm sure it depends on spacing and it depends on what kind of cable you're using, but is there a point after a number of years where you have to say, okay, it's time to recable?
Sometimes. Usually what happens is with like that bar, the barbless wire. So basically it looks like barbed wire. It's like two strands of heavy gauge wire with a coil around it without pointy barbs, which is what the Europeans use, and it's becoming more popular in the States now. That stuff will elongate to failure, so it sort of stretches out like taffy and gets thinner as it stretches, and it will just fail. So you'll have these points of failure, and it'll just break. That's usually why they're using more than one cable. So you'll see them run back and forth a few times till they have four or five sections of wire up there. That's also part of why you're not maybe seeing them retighten so much, because they've got multiple cables carrying the load. So, you know, share the load across many cable members, and you've got less stretch, as opposed to having a single member up there, which is going to take all the load in and deform quite a bit. Lifespan, you know, I don't know. We had 7x19 wire up for 15 years, and I never had to replace anything.
But you were tightening.
Oh, absolutely. Once you take the slack out from tension, and you can do that by pre-tensioning if you want, like tension the living hell out of it, and then leave it stretch, and it will relax. Everything's going to settle, as Chad talked about, right? And then you go and you retighten it again. But it's not just the cable that's stretching. It's also your fasteners. And so you can have, even if you're using cable clamps and you tighten the bejesus out of them, you're still going to have some potential slippage there. So look at your fasteners. If you're using those cable clips, the U-shaped ones with the bolts on the backside, I mean, those things loosen up over time too. You know, you could be getting some slippage there. You could certainly begin slippage in your anchors that you don't even see. They could be pulling up and you don't even know it. And it doesn't take much, you know, just a few inches of, you know, upward movement out of the soil is going to create some slack situations in your lines. So, and then you go and tighten it up, and pretty soon you keep pulling that. You're like, wow, why is my guy wire getting so much longer as I keep tightening it? Well, you're pulling your anchor out of the ground. So that there's so much force at play in a hop trellis, it just boggles the mind, and people really take it for granted.
And from so many different directions as well.
Yep, exactly. And that doesn't even include wind loading. Ah. So I did another calculation looking at, you know, wind loading, charted it. And again, sorry, these are in imperial units. I considered a wall of hops, 50 feet long, you know, a pole section, 18 feet tall of leaf surface area. And then I did a calculation as if it were a wall to figure out how many pounds per square inch of force a 5, 10, 20 mile an hour wind puts on that section. And then people are like, wait a minute, it's not a wall. I'm like, exactly. So then I derated that number by 60% because the wind will move through it. And I mean, it's a ridiculous number. You know, you get a 10 mile an hour wind blowing against a full hop section. Even if I derated it by 70%, you're still talking about an extra 1,000 pounds. A 10 mile an hour, you know, wind against a full section of hops, 50 feet is going to put an extra 1,000 pounds of force, or could, on that wire section that's already under 2,500 pounds of load, or 2,200 pounds just due to the weight of gravity. Yeah, there's a lot of force at play here. That's why your cables stretch.
Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. And, you know, for all that math, in case you didn't pull over to write it all down, engineeringtoolbox.com has a cable load section that is very handy and very graphical, and I will post it with the podcast when this goes live.
Yep. And that's one of my go-tos. There's a few other ones. If you want to look at cable stretch calculator, there's a Looz, L-O-O-S, cable company has a cable stretch calculator there for all different shapes and sizes, so you can play around with that and see how much you're looking at cable stretch. But really, to calculate this yourself, it's just trigonometry. So get out your kid's eighth grade math book and look up, refresh your sine, cosine, and tangent abilities, and you can calculate this yourself.
I wish now I had mentioned before you started talking that I was going to send the link out, because there are all these folks listening in their cars right now going, man, I pulled over, I pulled a pencil out from underneath the back seat, and I'm sitting here scribbling this on the back of an old utility bill that's on the side of the side
I'm
seat.
Sure. No, it isn't. It's a McDonald's bag. But yeah, so Chad, I hope that helps. It's not just, but it's not just cable stretch. It's also your fasteners. So pay close attention to those. And yeah, it's maintenance. It's not, you don't set it and forget it. It takes a lot of work.
So with that in mind, I mean, that's one thing that you see coming out of the winter. And it's, to Chad's point, it's winter. It's a great time for field maintenance that doesn't involve the frozen ground. What other advice can we throw out there for what you can do, again, for North America, for this time of year at least? What else can you be doing now to prepare?
Well, good question. Obviously, you're not doing much for planting.
Right.
But, well, it depends. You know, we had some folks on the Discord server talking about, my hops are already, you know, waking up in Pennsylvania because it's been so warm, and what do I do? So there is that potential. There are some folks in other parts of the country whose hops really never go to sleep, but that's a whole nother story. So let's pretend that they're actually still dormant. So for me, it was always about mechanical stuff. Mm-hmm. This is the opportunity I have to overhaul, fix, whatever, fabricate as much as I could, knowing full well that as soon as I get the pre-emergent down, it's off to the races until post-harvest.
Turn everything on once and make sure it actually starts.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's that. Usually getting ready for stringing twine. So what's your methodology? You know, we use scaffolds, and then we went to permanently installing hooks so we could hang from the ground. But is all that gear ready to go? Do I have, when is my twine getting here? Because I damn better well have ordered it in December. And sometimes it shows up in February. Absolutely, positively want to have it on farm by March. So it should be showing up soon.
And it's February now as we record this, early February. And I know I am seeing on Facebook people saying, I need twine. Who has twine?
Right. Too late. Mm-hmm. Way to go, guys.
I remember when we were, you know, basically overbuying twine and then reselling it. We had people coming to us at the end of December, and we were saying, sorry, we've already sold everything that's mm-hmm. coming in.
Yeah.
And they were mad.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And, you know, it was like, we only needed, you know, when we first started, we only needed a few bales, and then pretty soon we were buying half containers because we knew they were going to go somewhere, you know, and if we had more than a few bales, you know, at the end of the season, that was a lot. But it rarely happens. So, yeah, twine is something that you're, you know, stocking up on. Maintenance is the big thing. And that could be anything from, you know, tractor, vehicle maintenance, equipment maintenance, to grounds maintenance, you know, barn repair, you know, all that kind of stuff. Stuff that you know you need to have done before the season starts. Because once the season starts, you're never going to touch it again.
Sure.
Just general, you know, change in oil and fluids and filters and maintenance on hydraulic systems, that kind of stuff, is what I was doing. And when it got a little warmer, certainly in Wisconsin, when it got a little warmer, you know, into March, I would start fiddling around with the irrigation system. So while your plants are still dormant, for those of you in warmer climates, you know, make sure your irrigation system's running. We would run tests on each zone, you know, and we'd say, okay, we'd look at the manifolds, make sure the pressures were all right, make sure all the solenoids were working, that the controller's still working. And if it isn't, that usually meant some sort of vole or field mouse chewed through a wire somewhere. So then we'd have to go and check all those valves and whatnot, because you don't want to assume that it's okay, because it isn't. I mean, and even over the winter, we would find entire sections of drip line chewed in half by, I don't know what, a raccoon or
Dan?
Dan's in the field, you know, getting his polyethylene intake. So, you know, you turn the system on and then you'd be like, where's all the pressure? And then there's a geyser out there just, you know, blasting out at 60 PSI. So getting all that stuff maintained before the season starts is really critical. So you know that you're starting out at least stable. And then we would test the emitters. We would put put, you know, buckets underneath a drip line, a drip emitter, and run it for an hour and see if it is putting out a gallon, because that's what our emitters were rated to.
And, of course, it's got to be warm enough out that that water is going to flow.
Exactly. Certainly. Yeah, you don't want to do it, like I said, in Wisconsin. If we did it any earlier than late March, we were risking having those lines end up freezing and bursting. So we didn't want to do that. So, but it's still a dormant season activity you could do.
Sure.
Because winter doesn't mean the same thing in every part of the country. And those of us who are in the frozen tundra, we are greatly limited to what we can do in the off season, quote off season, the non-production season. The biggest thing that I do, sell. That's what you're doing in the off season. Yeah, I'm doing farm maintenance, but holy crap, this is the time I'm selling stuff. This is the time I'm going to conferences. This is the time I am networking, and yeah, and they're full days. So,
and you may just be finishing with your processing at this point in some cases.
Potentially, depends on how big you're. If you're doing your own processing, if you've got a little flat die mill and you've got like 5 acres, you could be processing till the cows come home. And yeah, you may just be finishing up. So you've got multitude of things about running your business that don't necessarily have anything to do with being in the yard at this time of year. I can't stress how critical that is, that you can't just let those times go, you know, the availability of that time go where you don't have to be in the yard. So, okay, what are you going to be doing?
Yeah, during the regular growing season, the days that go by where you say, man, there were so many things I needed to do today, but instead I was in the yard because I had to be.
Right.
You take advantage of that in the, as you said, non-growing season.
The non-growing season, yep. Not the off-season.
Yeah, now, the off-season always makes you mad when you hear that.
It does, yeah. The other thing that, well, we would do in the later years, and I say we didn't have an off-season because we also had a greenhouse. And it was right about now where we were waking the plants up from dormancy. So that added a whole nother layer of shit to do, you know, so our quote off season was a lot shorter than other people's. Mm-hmm. But the going to conferences and sales calls was a huge part of it.
Yep. Definitely a good time to do it.
Mm-hmm. So in some cases, really the only time.
Yeah. Unfortunate, but true.
If you're doing some sort of like pre-allocation program with brewers, now's the time where you'd be like, yeah, okay, this is what you want. And you know, it's quiet for brewers at this time of year in North America because, well, the beer festivals are in the low ebb and the tap rooms are, you know, 50% emptier. So brewers have more time now than they have at any other time of year.
True. True. Well, you should have done it during dry January when you had lower volumes of folks coming through.
Dry January.
I know. Let's I have people saying it with a straight face.
Yeah, I know, right?
So, you know, you mentioned the twine and the fact that in some cases it's too late to get it now. I'm racking my brain for anything else that in February you've already missed your window on.
In some cases, depending on how big you are or not necessarily how big you are, but I would say depending on your location relative to specialty cropping, you may be having issues already, especially if your plants are threatening to wake up soon, getting your chemicals. You may find yourself, okay, now I've got to go put my pre-emergent on because you just listened to our podcast on pre-emergence, and I'm going to use, you know, Tuscany, but that's such a specialty thing that my co-op can't get it for another month. Well, if your plants are already waking up, you can't wait a month to put your pre-emergent down. You're going to be behind the eight ball again. So getting all of your chemicals lined up and talking to your chemical providers, suppliers about what it is that you need moving forward, it's now. Absolutely, positively now. Yeah, I've seen so many growers, you know, even come to us, even now, saying, hey, do you have any of this chemical left over? Or do you have? Yeah, actually, I do. You want to buy it? Because they got caught out and the alternative is not pretty.
And you learn that, you know, knock on wood, you hope you learn that once and that you've immediately put on your electronic calendar right now for next October, buy my chemicals, buy my twine.
Right. it's part of the learning process for a lot of growers as they mm-hmm. expand. But yeah, it's do it now, or it should have been done by now, I should say, if it's winter and your plants are dormant. But a lot of times too, you get people that are looking at expanding, so working on doing some expansions, which is fine if you've got soil that you can get into right now. Absolutely, be out there and put some poles in. We would do it in the winter where we could. The risk of damaging anything is pretty low at that point, certainly if you've got frozen ground. And you know, most skid steer loaders with an auger can punch through fairly frozen ground and do as much of that sort of infrastructure work as I can. Gets me ahead of the game.
Sure. Makes a mm-hmm. lot of sense to get that done mm-hmm. in advance before things get too busy. Before Mother Nature guides you with her own timeline. Your timeline is much more yours to play with right now.
Right.
You get later in the season and you are just standing there going, yes, ma'am, doing what mm-hmm. she says.
Oh, yeah. I would say, too, the other thing that we haven't really talked about, because we talk about this being an early spring activity, but for those of you in areas where you have much more mild winters and your plants are quasi-dormant, you could be digging rhizomes. Easy peasy. Get in there, you know, get some crowns uncovered and cut some rhizomes. And you could even be transplanting right now if your soil's not frozen. That's an easy go-to. And get that out of the way so you're not having to deal with it when your plants are already awake and trying to grow in March, let's say, in warmer climates. Get those rhizomes out of the ground and get them transplanted. You know, you don't have to cut them and then store them and wait till later in the spring to plant them. Certainly if you have a, like I said, workable soil, do it now. And you might find labor to be more available too. Ooh, that's the other thing, labor.
Oh, scheduling your labor.
Yeah. If my date to get in the field to, first thing I would want to do is like get my pre-emergent and stuff down, if possible, before I start hanging twine. But let's say if I know I'm going to need labor to get my twine hung, get on it, make it happen, start lining it up, start advertising and put some dates, firm them up so that you know this is what we're going to start doing. Obviously, you want to have any of your winter/early spring field cleanup done. You know, if you're going to go through and mow the old crowns down, or if you're a hilling up kind of person, you're going to go through and do your crown carping at that point, but and bed reshaping. But once all that's done, get on it. get that string up. It was always the biggest pain in the ass for me is getting string hung every year. And just because it took so much labor and took so much time to do, the earlier I could get on it, the better.
Makes sense. Again, just getting it done in these days you have available, instead of saying, wow, it's cold outside, I can actually relax. There's no relaxing for you, Mr. Hop Farmer.
There's no relaxing in hop growing.
Okay, and that's the title of the episode.
there it is. Yep. That's what nice. I know about. That's what I know about, quote, off-season stuff.
Mm-hmm. So that started with a question about wire.
Yep.
So I can't stress it enough. We love your questions. Questions are great because they get us thinking. And obviously they get James riled up, which is what we all live for, is poking the bear.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, poking the bear.
Poking the bear.
Scott Manning at the Vintage was poking me yesterday because... Well, last Saturday, he and I and his wife went out and, you know, non-work related. We just went out to have fun. And so the Wisconsin Brewers Association, I think it is doing this thing for February called Blind Date, where they take two brewers from across the state at random and pair them up.
Oh, nice.
And they have to brew a collaboration together. And I thought that's a great idea because in Wisconsin, we do have some issues with... There's a lot of frenemies, let's put it that way.
Oh, this works great in junior high school where the cheerleader and the geek get put together.
Exactly, yep. So the one that Scott and Ceres Brewing in Columbus, Wisconsin, I think it is, they're teeny tiny. They brewed and you're going to be like, James, I can't believe you were interested in this. And that's what Scott said too. It was a cinnamon milk stout.
Cinnamon roll stout, I believe.
Yeah, cinnamon roll stout. Yeah, it's basically a milk stout with cinnamon. I'm looking for the...
I found it here. With Smith-Series Brewing in Columbus, Wisconsin, an English-style milk stout brewed with Wisconsin dairy lactose, Ceylon cinnamon, vanilla, and a touch of maple.
Yep, and it was outstanding. And it was they posted this thing on... Yeah, that this beer was out on their Facebook page, and I wrote, I'm like planning to try it this afternoon, and Scott chimed in. He said, James Altwise, you'll hate it. I ruined a perfectly good milk stout with spices, and you're a grumpy old curmudgeon who can't stand crap like that.
That's fantastic. And have you tried it?
It was great. And I told him, I'm like, I said, I found myself wanting like a little bit of chili pepper in it, because it would be very much like, you know, Aztec hot chocolate.
Yes, I could see that.
And he has a beer called El Scorcho, which is made with chilies and is quite good. It's like an amber with chilies. And he's like, maybe you should put a dash of El Scorcho in there. And I'm like, oh, man, now I got to go try it again.
I'm a little insulted that he didn't call that I'll punch you in the throat from when we played Beer the Name with him.
I'll mention it.
Because that was his feedback, was it's got to be something spicy.
I'll punch you in the throat.
You know what? Now, obviously, I have not tried this because it's 800 miles from me. But what I love about the description of this beer, and this is my pedestal, is that it's 4%.
Yep.
It would have been so easy to make that an imperial, because that's what the go-to would be.
Right.
And, you know, it's dessert. It's your last big alcohol punch of the night. I love that that is a drinkable, I hate the word sessionable, but that should be a comfortable beer to drink and not something that just hits you in the skull.
It's not a headache beer, mm-hmm. right? You know, those beers that are so high in alcohol, they give you a headache after you drink them. First I went in, I got a little taster. And I was like, can I give me a sip of that? I tasted it. I'm like, ooh, well balanced, which I expect from Scott. And said, okay, give me a pint. And I was drinking on it. And I'm like, yeah, this is probably going to be one of those beers I'm not going to have another pint of. All right, 3 pints later, it was really, really good. And it was really non-lactosey. You know, you can go overboard with that stuff. So I was very, very pleasantly surprised. So see, listeners, I am a grumpy old curmudgeon, but I also enjoy experimentation and some of these other things. It just can't be hazy or juicy.
And, you know, it's interesting because the other thing I was going to bring up, you had sent me a note about lagers making a comeback.
Huzzah!
And, you know, I've had a couple of lagers recently. I've had, surprisingly, at two craft breweries, two cream ales recently that were wonderful. And I know my friends think I'm a beer snob. And I don't consider myself a beer snob. I consider myself someone who's well-rounded, and I'll try just about anything. I know what I like, but I'm not going to say I'll only have 5% of what's out there. I will try just about anything out there, but I love that we're starting to see lagers and cream ales and beer come back again.
Yeah, and then I saw a post that Sierra Nevada paired up with Bitburger in Germany to create a triple-hopped lager. I'm like, don't do this to me. I don't want to see overhopped lagers be a thing, but it's going to happen.
Just when lagers come back, you'll get IPA
fans. If I see a juicy lager, I will punch somebody in the throat. But it's going to happen because it's like, just like I talked about in you know, a previous podcast about innovation and brewing. It's like, you know, just because you take something that exists and put a clock on it doesn't make you an innovator. It's don't take something that's really great and just add more hops and expect it to be good. So just stop. Just stop. Experiment with cinnamon lagers or cinnamon lagers. Do not experiment with cinnamon lagers. Experiment with cinnamon stouts and other things like that.
I don't know. So many of those Christmas beers, that's what they are. They're, you know, lagers and basic ales with cinnamon and allspice and
nutmeg. See
plenty of that going on too. Nutmeg, a lot of nutmeg.
Yep. Yeah. No, thank you.
All right. This is the grumpy old man section of our show.
It is.
We started talking about cats and weather. Yeah. And now we're yelling, get off of my lawn.
Yeah, let's not, you know, mince words. I gotta give me an outlet. I gotta have an outlet.
Why are my wires limp?